InsightView has talked to Steve Torson, Professor Emeritus of China Studies, Aarhus University, about what this website describes as a mini-cultural revolution in China. In China, it feels like the road of acceptable behavior has narrowed significantly in the last few years. InsightView asks Steve whether cultural revolution is the correct description.
First, thank you, Steve Torson, for taking part in this podcast. The latest events in China evoked to some extent memories of the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976. At that time, the revolution was initiated by Chairman Mao, who was under pressure within the party. Is this a correct comparison? And if so, what is Xi Jinping afraid of when he has nothing to fear?
I think the big difference between Mao and Xi is perhaps that Mao had this idea of mobilizing the masses and sort of trying to get beyond the bureaucracy and go to the grassroots and get people going. That was also why it was called a revolution. It's a bit difficult to see Xi Jinping in that role, I think. Mobilization of the masses and sort of direct participation in political campaigns is not really his style, as far as I can see. And also, the reason why Mao Zedong initialized the Cultural Revolution was that he was under a lot of pressure in the top echelon of the Communist Party. So he felt that he sort of needed the grassroots to support his own position. And I can't really see anything in the present situation that indicates that Xi Jinping should be in a sort of minority position or that he should be seriously pressed by the other top leaders. But of course, you always had to say that even before the first Cultural Revolution before 1966, practically all Western observers thought that Mao Zedong was in full control of the party. So we always had to consider that something might be going on behind the scenes that we don't know anything about. But as it looks from the outside, at least, it's very hard to see that Xi should be in a position where he would want to mobilize the people directly against other factions in the party. At least I cannot see that at the moment.
President Xi Jinping gradually resembles a real socialist, which in itself is probably the biggest surprise for many Chinese and foreigners. Can you tell us more about what are Xi Jinping's plans for the future? Does he represent the real thing, or is socialism just a tool to preserve his and the Communist Party's power?
I think socialism has been on the agenda of the Communist Party all along. And one of the problems is perhaps that we don't take the statements of the Communist Party seriously. We tend to believe that they are, you know, they're creating slogans and using phrases like socialism just as a sort of ideological cover of what they're sort of really doing. But I think one of the things we should pay attention to when we look at Chinese politics is actually what the Chinese leaders are saying, because many of the things that are happening now, I think, have been predicted in the speeches of Xi Jinping and others for quite some time. I mean, it's not a coincidence that back when the reform started and so on, they talked about the first stage of socialism. They had this idea of some people getting rich first and so on. And behind all this was an idea of, you know, the rest of the people getting rich later, right? It was never the end goal to create this very unequal society that we have now. And it was never the end goal to completely give away control of the economic sector. I think it's always been part of the socialist ideology and the ideology of the Communist Party that the state should be in control of the economy. And then there have been experiments about how to do that. But I don't think socialism is just sort of a mask they put on for celebrations. I think that the Marxist understanding of the economy and so on is deeply instilled in the leaders of the Communist Party. So I think it's something they take very seriously.
So do you believe that what's happening right now is more a correction of the direction so that we come back to the main road again?
It's difficult to say what the main road is, but it was obvious that, especially in terms of social inequality, it has grown very, very significant in China, right? And many Chinese have seen that as a problem. Right now, it's difficult to say what people in China think and what they worry about, because the whole public sphere has become so controlled. But if we go back to the 1990s and the 2000s, they had these opinion polls where they asked people, what are you concerned about in the development of China? And one of the things they would consistently say was social inequality, as it was reflected particularly in the care for the elderly and in the health sector, because many people experienced after the privatization of healthcare that, just one family member falling ill could ruin the entire family, right? So this thing about social inequality has been very high on the public agenda all along.
Today, President Xi often talks about common prosperity, the environment, controlling tech companies, corruption, and access to pensions and health services, which are also popular topics in Europe and the United States. Is Xi Jinping's broader socialist narrative supported by ordinary Chinese households? You talked a little bit about it in the previous question.
Yes, I mentioned that it's actually become more difficult for us to know what sort of ordinary Chinese households believe, because we used to have more Chinese academic research on this topic, and we used to have more reliable sources also from global companies that would do surveys in China, international researchers would do surveys and so on. Of course, that still takes place, but not to the same extent as it used to. And also, it's much harder now to judge from the social media what the sort of public opinion is in China, because the social media are also much more controlled now. But I think that I can go back to this list, of people's concerns back in the 90s and in the 2000s. There were three sort of top concerns. There was social inequality, as I already mentioned, but the two other ones were connected to the environment, air pollution, water pollution, the pollution of food, and then the second one, or the top priority of what people wanted changed was corruption. Right. So if you look at what Xi Jinping has done, he started out on the anti-corruption campaign, which actually directly addressed the top concern of the Chinese people. And I'm fully aware that he is using this campaign for all sort of other purposes, and is using it to get rid of his competitors and his opponents and so on. But he's really speaking to concerns in the Chinese population at the same time. I'm really quite certain about that. And he has also tried to address environmental issues, like air pollution in the big cities, for example, maybe not by solving the problem as such, but at least by moving the big polluting factories outside of the big cities. And he's done other things on that agenda as well, and the environmental agenda. And now he's sort of addressing the third big issue, which is social inequality. And I think this socialist narrative has a certain resonance in the Chinese population. But I think that many people also feel this control of the public sphere and their abilities of taking part in the debate and all this, that this has been weakened a lot. So there are definitely also people in China who worry very, very much about what we the whole tightening of the ideological atmosphere and this return to this discourse about, you know, moral purity and all that stuff. I mean, many people are, especially among intellectuals and so on, are very concerned about this at the same time. But that does not necessarily mean that they are also against the discourse of social equality.
In the same context, in China, it feels like the road of acceptable behavior has narrowed significantly in the last few years. What has happened to the democratization process started by the former leadership of President Hu Jintao and Prime Minister Wen Jiabao?
Yeah, that process has stopped. It's doubtful whether it was ever a democratization process, but it was another concept of how the political institutions in China should work, and especially of design of what we call the input mechanisms. I mean, if you have a one-party system without an opposition, how do you make sure that people's concerns and their ideas and so on are channeled into the political system so that the top leaders can implement policies that do not meet with a lot of resistance? Because even in an authoritarian system, it's very costly and to have a lot of opposition from the population. And the model on the Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao was that you should allow people more space for expressing their opinions. They called it consultative democracy. And in most of the Western literature, it was called like consultative authoritarianism. But it meant that you would have meetings of citizens. You would have panels of citizens. For example, if a local government wanted to pass a new budget, they would have discussions about, you know, what's the best way of using our money. So they would set up a panel of ordinary citizens, and they would call experts to discuss with them and present different ideas. And then there would be a sort of vote at the end, what are the priorities we want to make in this locality. And the Communist Party would not necessarily follow that priority, but they would really take it into consideration. These were just experiments, I have to say. I mean, they were going on in different parts of the country with different models and so on. But the idea was more or less the same, that you need to know what people think, what the ordinary people think, in order to design good policies. And that sort of consultation process has stopped under Xi Jinping. And he's now using another model, you say, where he tries to control local institutions from the top down, so that there would be inspection teams being sent down to institutions at all the different levels, going through all their books, looking at local complaints against them, interviewing people about how they are performing on their jobs and so on. And so it's a much more top-down control model for sort of running the political system. And I mean, they're still using the phraseology of democratization and so on, but the content has really changed, you know, from consultation to control.
Today, China is also exposed to an energy crisis. Is Xi Jinping fully aware of the economic consequences of the ongoing campaign, which appears to pose a significant risk to entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I don't know what Xi Jinping is aware of, but I know that in the Chinese education system, entrepreneurship has really become a big thing. So you can take university courses in entrepreneurship, and they call in, you know, model entrepreneurs, become sort of role models at the universities. They give talks about you know, how they invented stuff and how they got new ideas. And students are constantly encouraged to have this entrepreneurial spirit. And at least they are very much aware of the problem. But of course, it is a problem. Is it possible to control people's thinking to the extent that they're doing in China at the moment, and then at the same time have a creative and entrepreneurial population? I mean, can you sort of be innovative and entrepreneurial when you are at the job, and then be an obedient citizen as soon as you leave the office building, you know, and go home? And that's sort of a big experiment. But in the minds of the Communist Party, they believe it's possible to separate the two things, so that all the entrepreneurial and innovative, creative energy is channeled into production and sort of channeled out away from the political field.
Is it possible for you to define when you have become too successful an entrepreneur?
No, I don't think I can define it, but you can just try to look at the examples, perhaps, and go down in cases such as Jack Ma is the obvious example. I mean, at some stage, apparently, if you get big enough, you have to also be extremely loyal and sort of express your loyalty to the Communist Party. But it's still, I think, these things are still happening, right? And they're still trying to find out how to deal with that sort of successful entrepreneurs. I mean, we had a long time where they had seen, as I said, as role models and really promoted in society. Also locally, they are asked to go into the local People's Congress to be an entrepreneur has really been the sort of big ideal of what you should be, and now we're seeing kind of limitations, because the big fear of the Communist Party is always the development of alternative elites in any field, even in the economic field. And now I think they're sort of trying to define, to find out how do we make sure that we will not have a separate economic elite that sort of sees itself as a kind of opposition or interest group outside of the party. And these lines have not been, I mean, I don't think there's been a blueprint for how they would deal with that, but they're dealing with it. Now I think they're trying to find out how to make sure that they can integrate this entrepreneurial elite into the party.
Is Xi Jinping turning into a highly self-confident dictator, and does he have any reasons to sound self-confident?
I certainly think he is self-confident, but I'm not sure that you know, I don't use the word dictator myself, because it sort of gives you the idea that this one guy is sitting in Peking and getting ideas or making plans that he then tells his underlings, you know, now you go do this and so on. I think it gives an unclear image of the Chinese political process, because, of course, it is a huge bureaucracy, where legislation is actually a very complicated process. You often see when there's one law that's going to be passed through the National People's Congress, for example, it can take several years for that law to go through the Congress, because it's debated and you know, there are people pushing it in different directions and so on. So that's why I don't use the word dictator myself, because it doesn't give you the right impression of how the political system works in China. There are actually a lot of actors pushing in different directions, different localities, at provincial level and even lower, you know, different sectors of the economy and so on. But yes, there is, of course, a risk that, I mean, that's sort of what we believe about liberal democracies, right? That one of the strengths is that you get all these different opinions, and based on the different opinions, you people make decisions about who to elect, and then these people design policies that are better than they would have been without the discussion. But we don't really know how much discussion takes place in the inner circles of the Communist Party. What we can see now is that the open discussion of political issues, it has been weakened very significantly. But we cannot be sure whether different sectors of the economy, for example, through their representatives, still have influential voices in the top leadership. And that's something that makes, you know, the study of Chinese politics so difficult, is that there are many of these mechanisms inside the top leadership that we don't really know very much about. I think the risk for Xi Jinping focusing attention so much on himself is that it has to generate some sort of opposition somewhere, right? Just like the corruption campaign, I mean, he's put down so many other leaders. And now, you know, he places all the focus on himself in the public sphere. And we can just guess that there are people out there in the leadership also who feel that this has already gone too far. Like, if you just look at the next generation, right, we've always had this, well, not always, but at least since Deng Xiaoping established this system of, you know, 10-year rules that Xi Jinping is probably breaking now. There's always been this idea, you know, that after 10 years, there'll be a new generation, they'll take over and so on. And there's a whole generation now who can see that that's not going to happen to them. I think there is there might be some sort of opposition to Xi Jinping. The problem is that we cannot say very much about that opposition because it's not out in the open, exactly because of the very close political nature of the close nature of the political process in China right now.
Today, in the West, we often criticize President Xi Jinping when it comes to his campaign against the private sector, in particular the tech sector. On the other hand, there are many similarities between what President Xi is doing and what politicians in Europe and the United States are trying to do, for instance, confronting the tech sector. Do you agree?
Yes, I think they are very much addressing the same agendas, actually. And in a way, I think that's a very fruitful way of looking at Chinese politics. You know, there are these issues that are common to many countries around the world. You could also add climate change, of course, environmental pollution and so on, and the things you already mentioned. And these are problems that all governments have to address, regardless of whether they are democratic governments or authoritarian regimes like in China. And sometimes I think that to take these problems as a starting point and then look at how are different governments dealing with these problems is probably a more fruitful way of approaching Chinese politics than simply starting out from the ideological differences and making it a question of whether you're a democratic country or an authoritarian country. It can be much more useful, I think, to look at the similarities of the agendas than to look at the political institutions. And I think that is how we have to approach China. We have to look at what problems are they addressing and what are they doing about them. That I think that's basically the way we should look at China.
Thank you, Stig Thøgersen, for taking part in this podcast.
Well, thank you.